This talk was given by Prabhu Gikan Vasan at the Zen Center of New York City. Gikan is a senior lay student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ccnyc. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. My name is Gikan, and I was asked to give the talk today. Well, first, let me just say how good it is to be back here. I live upstate now with my wife, Hosui, but most of my training and Zen practice has happened here in this space, and it's always just really wonderful to come back here. Now, I was sort of thinking yesterday in the half-day sit that we had that, you know, in some ways this space, it holds us in a way that even the monastery upstate doesn't, and I'm not sure what it is, something about maybe the smallness of the space compared to like the big Zendo we have up there or something about it, but there's a real holding here that doesn't really happen even up there. So as most of us know, today marks the end of our fall practice period. 3 months ago, first let me back up just for people who are new. You know, from the time of the Buddha, through the entire history of Buddhism, practice has always kind of oscillated between periods of practice that were more solitary, right, more sort of self-motivated, where the energy really has to come from ourselves, and periods that were more communal, right, where the community would come and really just come together and intensify their practice. So we do those intensive periods in the fall and the spring. So 3 months ago, a number of us entered the practice period formally. We made commitments. We looked at the areas of our spiritual practice that needed shoring up, that needed help from each other, from the teachers, that needed the umph of a commitment, and we made that commitment. And the theme for this practice period, as we know, has been the Buddha ancestors, the lineage of teachers, of practitioners who've come before us. And so we studied the lives of a number of these teachers, both men and women, through their poetry, through stories about them, etc. We studied the lives of the Buddha in that sort of traditional way of viewing things as occurring over multiple lifespans. And, you know, whether or not we believe that, from a teaching point of view, it was really pretty nice to see just the evolution of the Buddha, right, as he evolved into the person that he was when he clarified things, right? And I think most importantly, we studied our own lives, right? We studied us living here and now, to really see how can the lives of all these teachers who came before us inform us as we live and practice in this time and place. So what I wanted to do today was to turn to some of the early women, right? The women whose poetry we studied. These were Theravadan practitioners very early in the history of Buddhism. Some actually studied with the Buddha himself. So this goes very early back. And I want to just kind of look at their words, their struggles, and their practice to see what they have to say to us. And so I want to start with a poem by the nun Patakara, whose name we actually chanted this morning in the list of women teachers. And she starts this way: "Why have I not experienced freedom? When I'm virtuous and I do what the teacher taught, when I'm not lazy and I'm calm." And I really like this because I think in some ways she's asking a very basic question that I think is the first question that maybe most of us or all of us ask in one form or another when we decide to come to this place. Right? When we decide to take up this, whatever this means for us, whether it's our first Sunday or whether we've been here for hundreds of Sundays, and done a lot of practice, right? You know, Patakara seemed to be leading a pretty good life. You know, I'm virtuous. I'm a good person, right? I'm not lazy. She was energetic, right? I'm calm. You know, she wasn't agitated. She was calm. And yet, she still has the question, why haven't I experienced freedom? And I think, like Patakara, we do the same thing. You know, we try to live our life the best that we can. You know, by training, I'm a clinical social worker, and I've seen a lot of different people for counseling and therapy sessions, and a lot of those people, most of them, were trying their best. even when they were making bad decisions, even when they knew they were making bad decisions, at that time, at that place, in those circumstances, they were doing what they thought was the best that they can do. Right? So we try our best. And still, for all of that, even if we're successful, I think for many of us, we feel that there's something lacking. In preparing this talk, I was sort of thinking about the various ways I've heard that expressed from people. Either during the open shares that happen after our meditation intensives up at the monastery, or just in conversations I've had, or in the little pieces that students will sometimes write for our journal. And I've seen it expressed in different ways. Some people express it like Patacara did. They frame it as the positive qualities that seem to be missing. Freedom, my life isn't joyful, my life isn't free. Some frame it as negatives. The things in their life that are causing them difficulties, right? Discontentment, stress, anger, mistreating the people they love. I remember one guy I spoke to years ago. We were just talking, shooting the shit about practice. And I asked him, well, how come you're doing this? And he said, it's because I don't treat the people I dislike well. Instead of people I love, I treat them well. But when I encounter people I dislike, whose views I disagree with, I'm really shitty to them. And that was the way he framed it, which I think is just a wonderful way to frame it, right? I mean, in some ways, this, I think, is going back to these early women. I think this is most graphically seen in the story of Kisa Gotami, another nun we chanted today. Before she became a nun, she was a homemaker. She had a child, and the child died, and she was absolutely devastated by this. And her story says that, she went from house to house carrying her dead son, begging people for medicine to bring her son back to life. And people told her that your child is dead, and she refused to accept it. And she went on and on from house to house until finally someone directed her to the Buddha. Right? In some ways, I find that a very powerful story because it really almost graphically represents how we can carry something with us. In her case, literally, carry something with us that is, that despite all of our best efforts, is still keeping us from being free. The interesting thing, though, is that Patacara was actually practicing when she said this. Right? She said, I do what the teacher taught. And I want to make sure by teacher, she meant the teacher, the Buddha. I mean, that's the guy she was studying with. And even then, doing exactly what he said, she still wasn't free. Right? She had found the teacher. Another nun, Uttama, said it like this. Five times I've left the monastery. My heart not at peace. My heart out of control. Right? So she was actually a practicing nun at the time. And I have sort of had this image of her just running out of the monastery again and again, completely out, just her heart just completely, whatever that meant to her, whatever it maybe means to us, out of control and not at peace. And this is something I think I've also heard from people, and I've certainly have experienced. Initially, practice does provide relief, right? The act of sitting. When I used to, in therapy, I didn't bring Zazen into my therapy sessions a lot, but the few times I did it, even just that basic Zazen I would teach, not even meditation, people would find relief. There's a certain settling that happens. And of course, if we come here enough, we find each other, right? And there's companionship, right? I remember when I, briefly, one of the things that led me to practice was depression, right? And part of my depression was I would isolate myself. And I remember for those first couple of years, the reason I came here on Sundays was just to be around other people. That's what got me here, right? So initially, practice in its various forms does provide relief. But I think what happens is that, and that's fine. And people sometimes get that, and that's absolutely fine. Right? That's an alleviation of suffering, and that's perfectly fine. And I think people still often express that there's, despite that relief, there's something that they're missing, or that they're missing something about this practice. There's maybe a sense that the freedom that Patacara talks about is larger than just the alleviation of the stress or turmoil that might bring us here. It's kind of funny, as part of my work as a social worker, I would run anger management groups And so, you know, these were often, they're almost always clients who are mandated to come either by their employer or by, you know, as a condition of their parole or whatever, you know, they're sort of mandated, to come there. And, you know, it was a curriculum, a 10 session curriculum, 12 session, whatever. And at the end, you know, they did what they had to do and we'd have a certificate at the end. They could then take back to their PO or to the courts or whatever. And at the very final session, you know, and people were just doing this just to get that certificate. I mean, that's what they wanted. And at the very end, before handing them out, I'd say, all right, you're not done yet. And they'd all look at me like, what? Like, wait, no. This is not what you said. You're not done yet. I said, you know, yeah, you've done anger management, but now you need to move on to happiness management. Right? And I would tell them that. And I'd say, you know, it's, you diminished your anger. That's fine. You know, you have less of the bad stuff. That's great. But now you need to cultivate the good stuff. I don't think any of them really bought it. They usually just took their certificates and walked out the door. But I think for us, right, maybe for us, for me anyway, you know, it wasn't important just to get rid of the bad stuff, right? I had to get the good stuff. So how do we get to the good stuff here? Patakara continues. Right? She asks why I've not experienced freedom, and then she continues. While washing my feet, I made the water useful in another way by concentrating on it as it flowed downhill. I love that image. This is just a completely everyday activity. I mean, in India, even to this day, before you go into someone's house, you wash your feet. Right? Because the roads are dusty. Most people wear sandals. My understanding is that back then, they actually often walked barefoot. And so you wash your feet. This is an act that she probably did thousands and thousands of times. Right? But this time, this particular time, something was different. I made the water useful in another way. That's how we get to the good stuff here. If you think about it, practice takes exactly what we're already doing. Right? I mean, you did kinhin today, right? As long as you need to stretch your feet between periods of sitting, make it useful. Make that act of walking useful in another way. Another nun, Sona, she was asked to boil water, and she said, having fetched the water, I put the cauldron on the stove and sat. Then my mind became composed. Again, you know, this is a woman. She used to be a homemaker. She's probably boiled hundreds and hundreds of pots of water. She did something different that time. Heck, Zazen. You know, what did you learn in beginning instruction today? Zazen, right? As long as you're breathing, as long as you happen to be breathing, let's put that breath to use in another way, right? For those of you who've done Orioki, our ceremonial meal that we do during meditation retreats, you know, what do, right? We put out our bowls, we get a few bowls of food, we eat it, we clean up our bowls, and we put it away. But if you've ever been in it, right, every piece of that is put to use in another way. And again, this is most radically seen with Kisagatami, right? She took her dead child to the Buddha. And what the Buddha did was absolutely remarkable. She said to the Buddha, she walked up to him and said, you know, do you have medicine? Bring my son back to life? And he said, yeah, I do. She's like, okay, well, what is it? And he goes, go around and find a house where I can get a handful of mustard seeds. And she said, I can. And he said, but it has to be from a house where nobody died. Right? And so she went off and she did this, right? She went from house to house. Again, I never got this really until I kind of prepared this talk and I realized how brilliant that was. He met her exactly where she was. As long as you're completely distraught in grief and going from house to house, we're going to put that to use in another way, right? And he gave her a practice that met her exactly where she was at. And she just asked her to continue doing it, but in another way. And it said that as she did this, she began to realize that her child wasn't going to come back. And she began to realize some truths about life and death and impermanence. Right? Doing what she had been doing probably for days, but doing it another way. So practice asks us to take what we've always done and to put it to use. But let's take this one more step. What is the use that we're putting all this to? Okay. That's important to ask that. So I want to work a little bit with a poem by another nun, Mittakali. I don't believe we chanted her name here, although we might have. Sometimes the names are a little bit different. She starts her poem like this. I went forth in confidence from home to homelessness. I wandered about, looking for gain and recognition. I ignored the highest goal. So Mittakali was a spiritual practitioner. The phrase going from home to homelessness means ordaining as a monastic. I think even to this day in Japan, monastics are known as home leavers. Right? So back then, that's what that meant. You went into homelessness, you became a, you ordained. You left your life and you ordained. So she ordained. And what did she say? You know, like Patakara, who we looked at before, like most of us, she was approaching this whole thing with her best qualities. She was looking for gain and recognition. Right? Maybe recognition as being a really good monk, good spiritual practitioner, maybe some gain, some status in the community. And she was confident about this, went forth in confidence. Right? This is actually kind of a funny story. One of the other nuns who we chanted today, Bada Kundalakesa, she was actually known as one of the most famous debaters in India. And the way she would do this was she would go into, from town to town. It's amazing they could do this back then. She'd go from town to town, and she'd sit, and she'd make a pile of sand, and she'd plant an apple branch into the sand, and that was a sign that she was ready to take people on a debate. And she would just beat people, apparently. You know, she was one of the best debaters in India. And so one day she went into the town where Shariputra, one of the Buddha's disciples, we chanted his name in the Heart Sutra this morning, happened to be. And she planted her stick. I think this is just delightful. It's what happened was that Shariputra sent a bunch of children over to her to trample her sand pile and knock her apple branch down, which I think is just amazing, actually. You know, I just love this image of all these children coming over, messing up her sand pile and running. You know, it's already like the bubble of the ego has popped there a little bit. And then he debated her. And that's how she entered practice. She entered practice as, again, bringing her best qualities. You know, I'm a good debater. I know how to do this. Let's do it. And so they start in some ways as we all start. They start this practice by seeking what they think is important, what they thought was important, what they thought they needed in order to, you know, have a good life. Right? And to an extent, that was perfectly fine. Right? I've never encountered a single thing here in the time I've been here where it said that the things I felt I needed for my life, I shouldn't have. Right, that's fine. But from the point of view of practice, each one of these women, one of these practitioners, entered practice as a person who isn't free. And more importantly, at that moment, as a person who couldn't even imagine what freedom really is. Right? So they entered that way, and they practiced that way. And it turns out that was perfectly, perfectly fine. That was exactly okay. That was exactly what they needed to do. So Mittakali continues, right? I went forth in confidence from home to homelessness. I wandered about looking for gain and recognition. I ignored the highest goal. Then, while I was seated in my hut, I began to fear the inevitable. I knew I was on the wrong road, under the rule of craving. Life is short. Old age and illness already crush me. There's no time to waste before this body is broken by old age. So there's a lot happening in these lines, and I sort of want to go through it. But I think the most important part is that initial, what she's saying initially. Then while I was seated in my hut. She means meditation. Right, so everything that follows here needs to be understood as being done and being experienced within that context, within the context of meditation, of zazen. And that's important because everything that follows is just a precise description of how zazen works. So, I was seated. So the first thing that jumped out at me is, she's no longer confident. Right? I began to fear the inevitable. That initial confidence, I know what I need. Right? I know what's working for me. I just got to keep doing it. I know what I need. This is what I need. I need gain. I need recognition. I need to win one more debate. Right? That's gone. Right? For Bada, the debater, the story is, it goes like this. So Shariputra and her met. I guess she got to ask the first round of questions, and Shariputra answered them all. Then it was Shariputra's turn, and it says he asked just one question to her. What is the one? And it said, at his first question, what is the one, she remained silent. Surely he didn't mean God, or Brahman, or the infinite. She thought some more, and she said, well, everybody needs food and nutrition, but surely he doesn't mean that. What was it then? Admitting defeat, she asked Shariputra for the answer, and then he sent her to the order of nuns to be ordained, to be trained, and to be introduced to practice. Right. To me, that's a very powerful story. Those of us who work with koans might actually recognize this, right, about what happened here. You know, there's a question was dropped into her consciousness. For her, it's what is the one? And she began to work with it. Right? She's a debater. Right? She began to work with this in the way that her mind knew how to work with things. And she began to crank through all the possibilities. Right? God, Brahman, infinite. Well, wait a minute, the one, everybody needs food. Is it food? Pa-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Right? And personal experience, that's what happened to me anyway. Yeah, with working with koans or working with any part of this practice, right? We do what our mind does what it knows how to do until it realizes it has no idea what to do with that question. In other words, we hit that limit. Right? Just like Mita Kali hit the limit of her confidence. We hit that limit and we allow that limit to drop away. Right? In Bada's case, she admitted defeat. Right? But not defeat as in, you know, now I'm completely crushed. Everything that I thought was good is bad, and now I can just, you know, I've just been obliterated. No, she asked Shariputra for the answer. Right? So she admitted a defeat that allowed her to take the next step. For Mita Kali, I began to fear the inevitable. I knew I was on the wrong road, under the rule of craving. Life is short. Old age and illness already crush me. There's no time to waste before this body is broken by old age. Right there, you know, she's essentially doing what we offer from the beginning. From the moment you get beginning instruction, right, is exactly what she's doing right here. She's seeing what her mind does. Right? She's essentially taking what we call the backward step or turning the light around, right? And she's seeing what her mind does, right? I was under the rule of craving, right? There's a lot of depth there in terms of what craving means, that term in Buddhism. But essentially what she was seeing is she began to realize that she was under her mind was creating these limits, grasping at those limits, that's the craving, right? And she began to see how those limits were confining her. Essentially, she took the step that all of us take from our very first time here. So essentially, at that moment, the person who isn't free is now realizing their confinement, right? I can't answer that question, what is the one, right? Whatever I've been taught to do so far isn't working. Right, that confidence isn't serving me right now. I'm afraid. I'm getting afraid, and I'm realizing what my mind is doing to keep me there. And then, there's no time to waste. Right, that phrase, there's no time to waste, is an important one. It's what we refer to sometimes when we say raising the Bodhi mind. Right, there's an urgency there. Right, it's no longer about gain or recognition. Right. At that moment, there's an urgency to me anyway when I read that. There's no time to waste. It's the urgency to end suffering. Right. It's this urgency now to begin practice. For Kisa Gautami, right, after she went from house to house with the mustard seeds, she realized her child wasn't coming back and she buried her child. And she actually then came to the Buddha. And the Buddha said, so have you gotten the seeds? And she said, done, sir, is the business with the mustard seed. Please grant me refuge. That is, please ordain me. And again, she cranked through what her mind was leading her to do. She hit that limit. right? And she was able to then take that next step and to ask for the teaching and to really enter practice with that sense of urgency. So this is the use that we're asked to put all of these practices to. Right? We're asked to use all these practices to see the limits that we've placed on ourselves. That's all. To see the limits that we've placed and what happens when those limits fall away. It's very simple, right? That's essentially what we're asked. And these women I'm quoting from phrase it in different ways. Mitta Kali says, you know, after there's no time to waste, she said, you know, seeing that a person is made up only of impersonal parts, seeing those as they changed over time, waxing and waning, my mind was freed. Sona, the woman with the boiling the water, after she boiled the water, she said, you know, I composed my mind and I saw the aggregates as impermanent. Bada, the great debater, she said, I observed the little stream of water. Through that stream, I knew the process of rise and fall. That language isn't language that we generally tend to use here. Right? We don't usually speak of the aggregates and seeing the parts as impersonal. We speak of it differently, right? We speak of the language we tend to use as intimacy or wholeness. Right? That might be a little bit more familiar. So an example of that might be when we're working with the breath and we begin to get closer to the breath. Right? Where, you know, it's no longer us out here and our breath here, and we sort of have to kind of keep a distance from it. We get closer to it. Sometimes we call that being the breath. Right? Or working with pain. Right? What's the instruction when you work with pain? Right? Be the pain. Right? Enter the pain completely. I remember once, deep into a meditation retreat, I was in an enormous amount of pain. Right, and my knees were just like on fire. Like I was in so much pain, it was like unreal. And so I'm thinking, like, oh God, when's this gonna stop? When's that stupid timekeeper gonna ring? Just ring the bell already, Jesus Christ! Just ring the bell. I'm cranking through. Like, when's this gonna end? And suddenly a voice broke in. Maybe this will never end. Like, maybe this is it. Maybe this will simply never end. And I think, you know, personally speaking, that was a moment when I hit that limit and I just let that limit drop away. Right? And I just simply settled. Right? Settled into that pain. Just bodily, just settled into it. Right? So in either framework, right, whether we're talking about the old school way of talking about this as impersonal parts or the way we talk about it as wholeness and intimacy, the same thing is happening. Right, in either framework, what happens is the absence of a person. Right? What we see then is who we are when we're not the person that we bring into practice. Right? And another word for that is freedom. Right? The freedom that Patekara was talking about. That freedom when those limits that we thought we needed, that we thought we wanted, that we thought were getting us what we wanted, are no longer limits. And then we see what's left. And what's left is freedom. And that freedom functions in different ways. You know, one of the most powerful stories I think we read, and I keep going back to Kisagatami, the woman with the dead child, because it's a very powerful story. Much later in her practice, right, this is later in her practice, she's sitting in the forest doing meditation, and Mara appeared and asked her and said, you know, your child is dead. How can you just sit here doing meditation? So Mara's like a reappearing figure in Buddhist literature. He's like, you know, like you got the angel on one side and the devil on the other side. Mara is like the devil. So we can sort of understand Mara as that part of our psychology, right, that leads to self-doubt, doubt in the teachings, self-loathing and discouragement, the stuff that we carry around that can derail our practice. So she was sitting doing meditation, and this part of her spoke up. Your child is dead. How can you just sit here doing this? And what she said in response was, I've gotten past the death of my son. I don't sorrow. I don't weep. Nor do I fear you, friend. You know, and if you think about this, this is just amazing, right? I mean, this is the occurrence in her life, the fact that drove her out of her mind, right? She was running with this dead child from house to house. I mean, just picture this, right? I mean, she was running from house to house with it. That same experience, she can now look at it directly, completely directly, and say, I don't weep anymore. I'm not afraid of you, friend. That's how this freedom functions, right? We stop fearing ourselves. Right? Those very parts and qualities that have caused us turmoil in the past become included in who we are. Completely included. And that inclusion grows. Certainly for me, I can speak that it's grown as I keep hitting the limits of who I think I am and allowing those limits to fall away. I just wanted to offer like a quick personal example. And this has to do with, you know, the this what's been going on for a long time, but it's actually just kind of come into public consciousness more often in the last few years, my consciousness anyway, and that's all of the people of color, the men of color, the women of color, the children of color who've been killed by police. About a year and a half ago, there was a boy, Jordan Edwards, an African-American boy, 15 years old, and he was shot to death by a white police officer. From my understanding is that he was drinking, and the cops were called. A bunch of the kids were drinking, or teenage drinking, and the police officer fired 5 shots into the vehicle they were driving and killed Jordan. And during the hearing, he claimed that the car was approaching him, so he was afraid, but the body cam showed the car was actually moving away from him when he shot into it. So this past summer, towards the end of the summer, this police officer was found guilty and was sentenced to 15 years in jail. And, you know, when I first read about what happened, of course, you know, this is, of course, has been coming within the context of this, all those other whether you want to call them police killings or, you know, state-sponsored murders, whatever you want to call it, depending on what your frame of reference is, because I've read a lot of different frames, when all of that was coming out. And, you know, I was outraged, I was angry, I was devastated. And without knowing it, I really had made this division in myself where, you know, the cops were bad, the people who were being shot were good. And I was absolutely clear about, you know, who deserved to be punished. You know, I was absolutely clear about how I should feel about that. And then this article came out about this officer who was sentenced. And the article had his picture. And I looked at him. And this is picture they snapped it right when the sentence was being read. And I saw him. He was wide-eyed with fear and devastation. And I just took his picture in. Right? And in my reading of it, you know, his devastation had to do with the fact that his life had been suddenly sent careening into a future he never expected. And, you know, I sort of worked with this. I journaled with it a little bit. I sat with it. And, you know, I realized that, you know, for him, that entire armor that he'd probably been carrying around with him his whole life, that armor of race privilege, of white privilege, of power, and of kind of, you know, state-sponsored, whatever, invulnerability, was just completely crumbled away. And I was looking at the face of a fragile and fearful human being. And my heart broke. My heart completely broke for him. This person, who I was absolutely clear before that I could never feel this way for. Right? I was completely broken for him. And I realized I don't want anyone to feel this way. That's an example, I think anyway, at least in my own practice, of hitting that limit of what I think is correct, of how I think I need to move through the world, and having that limit just fall away. You know, of course, it's a work in progress, right? In order for this to happen, I had to see him in that way. I've been trying to work with this when I see other images of all the various groups, the Proud Boys, the white nationalist groups, groups that are still kind of, you know, in the prime of their power, right? Groups whose rhetoric is being amplified at the highest levels of government. The groups who can essentially, I think, still be pretty confident that the machinery of the state will never be used against them. When I look at them in that prime, I can't go there. Be honest. My heart doesn't break then. Right? I'm not there yet. But in some ways, you know, I think I know how to get there or how I will get there. At some point, I'll reach a place where I see that limit. I already see that limit, but I'll be able to see it fall away. So, our fall practice period is pretty much over. I just wanted to end by just a very brief couple of lines from one of these nuns. Her name is Sona. I don't think we chant her, but we just want to offer this. This is just two lines from one of her poems. What counts is that the heart is settled and that one sees what really is. You know, I wanted to offer that because, you know, this practice period is over. We're now going to be moving into our winter practice period, right? We've been moving into winter. Jeez, you know, we seem to already moved into winter here in, like, you know, middle of November. Things are going to get colder, darker. Right? Those of us who work with our moods might find our moods getting darker, colder. So during that time, you know, when we need the teaching to be quick, when we need something just, it's got to be quick, it's got to work now. What counts is that the heart is settled and that one sees what really is. When she says the heart is settled, she doesn't mean it's settled because things are going our way. That's not the heart being settled. That's just being on top. That's Buddha with the apple branch knocking the debaters one after the other, you know, to the side, right? That's what that is. And that's fragile. But Buddhism doesn't discount that. I mean, from what I recall, the Buddha declared Bada to be the foremost of none in terms of understanding. He recognized her strengths. So we don't discount this, but we also recognize how fragile they are. You know, the heart becomes settled when we see what really is. Right? That is, when we see who we are, when we're not a limit of ourselves, we're not a version of ourselves. And as I learned, when I saw who my enemy is, when I'm not making them my enemy. That's when the heart can be settled. So, as we move into our next season and our next day of practice, our next morning of practice, let's really turn to our practice. Let's turn to these lessons that have come down from way, way, way back, right? These earlier practices, they went through what we're going through. They really did. And that's a good thing. It means we don't have to kind of make this stuff up, right, from scratch. You know, there's precedents, there's lessons, there's wisdom, a big body of it that we can draw from. So, thank you, everyone. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the Monastery Store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.